for your words. And now I'm going to hand it over to Olia, Jim, and Derek from our Futures Compliance Department to start us off with our first session for the day.
Okay. So like it says on the agenda, this session, I think, focuses on what I think are some of the hottest topics right now, particularly artificial intelligence, digital assets, and advertising. So why don't we go through real fast and just kind of introduce us individually so you know who we are, Olia?
Hello.
Sorry, Chicago was very quiet. I'm Olia Hominiak. I'm a senior manager in exams in the Chicago office.
Yeah. Hello, my name is Jim Hurahan. I'm a manager in the compliance department conducting digital asset exams.
And my name is Derek Janik. I'm a manager on the what we call the specialist group. So I specialize in mostly advertising, but also disclosure documents and a few other odds and ends here and there. One thing, though, I don't have the clicker.
I have it.
Oh, you have it.
Oh. Okay.
Okay. So to start us off, I think the first topic, like I said, is really, I think, one of the hottest topics right now, and I think it's kind of on everybody's lips at the moment, which is artificial intelligence. So, Olia, do you want to get us started off?
Sure. So as Derek said, it really is a hot topic right now, and I'm sure you can't get away from it in your personal life. It's all over my internet, at least, and all the AI-generated pictures and things like that. But obviously, NFA is focused on member usage of AI. And since we have a lot of cross-registered members also with the SEC, we've been reaching out also to FINRA and the SEC to see what kind of information they're gathering from their members to see how they're using AI. And it's seemingly we're in the same kind of position. So I'll say if you've had an exam of us probably in the past year and a half, you'll have seen these questions from us. But generally, right now, we're still, in fact, gathering kind of state status, even though it's been a year and a half, just because AI has not been prevalent in the futures industry as it is used in a customer-facing format. So if you've had an exam, you'll have seen questions from us like, are you using generative AI, or do you have any kind of LLM models in place? Had you said yes, we would have had much more questions covering kind of a very broad area such as governance. Have you put together committees, procedures, those kind of things? How are you monitoring your staff usage of AI? Let's say you're allowing your staff to use ChatGPT. How are you making sure that they're not putting in information that they really shouldn't be, that it maybe your company proprietary information is not going into ChatGPT or any open source AI, or any customer data is not going in there. Also, if maybe the firm has developed their own kind of like internal ChatGPT system, maybe they've developed their own AI, how are they monitoring how staff are using it? What kind of data are they feeding in? Are they looking at the results to see if they're reasonable results? Who's monitoring the output? Those are just some of the questions we would have had we had an exam of you and your firms were doing any kind of uses of LLMs or generative AI. The questions I frequently get is, well, we're not using it for futures, or it's not external right now. Our questions are overarching over the whole firm, regardless of where the use is, because this is a developing technology. We've had it where we went to a firm let's say a year ago, the answer was, oh, we're only using it for internal research. About 6 months later, they're now using it for something external. This is a moving target for a lot of firms that are trying to develop this technology. So we're trying to, where our questions are kind of, what is happening right now, and we kind of monitoring it going forward. Can you go to the next slide? So one of the main questions we get is, well, there's no rules that NFA has made over AI. And this is really just a technology that's living out there that is not really a new product that we would have had to have made a rule at this point about. It doesn't mean that we won't ever make an AI-centric rule, but right now we feel that especially these few rules that are on the slides generally cover anything the AI might be touching. And the first one is obviously supervision, that's 2.9, NFA compliance rule 2.9. The firm's required to supervise all operations. AI is not going to be something very separate from generally your operations. What we've seen is AI is touching a lot of different areas. Maybe it's used for research. Maybe it's used to put together documents. Who's reviewing those documents? Are those documents then going to customers without you making sure that it is reflecting what your operations are? If you're using a third party that is heavily into AI and it's as the third party is a regulatory duty that you're required to do as a firm, we have the third party service provider interpretive notice. You're required to monitor that thing on an ongoing basis, what's being used by this third party, what they're telling customers. Are there issues here? Should you discontinue use? Once again, kind of goes back to supervision. And the big one of things which we have been seeing already customers, firms using is touting AI and promotional material, and I'm going to throw that over to Derek as the promo specialist.
Yeah, so before I get into promotion material, does anybody have any questions real fast for Olia? Anything she covered? All right, so like Olia said, we don't really yet have, and I don't know if we ever will necessarily, have rules specific to the use of artificial intelligence. But I think it's important to note that our rules are what I like to call technology neutral. So for those of you, hopefully all of you, who are familiar with NFA Compliance Rule 229, it covers the use of promotion material. So 229 says that, you know, if you have promotion material, you can't say anything that's misleading. You can't omit information that causes it to be misleading. If you talk for potential for profit, you have to talk about the risk of loss. So, I mean, all the basics. And all those basics apply pretty much regardless of what you're using to create your promotion material. So whether you are, you know, if you go to, for example, the CME's website and you take their promotion material off their website and you hand that to a client or you email it to a client, when you're giving that to a client, whether it came from a third party, whether it came from ChatGPT, it's still your promotion material. So all of those rules, so all of 229 still applies to you because you're the one who's using that promotion material. So when it comes to AI and promo, I think there's two main components here, two main things that we want to kind of consider, and that is the use of AI to generate promotion material and then claims about AI in promotion material. So when it comes to using AI to generate promotion material, I think this is something that we are finally beginning to see. And, you know, none of our members are necessarily coming right out and saying, hey, I use ChatGPT to write all my promo for us. But it is one of those things that it seems like in looking through some of the promo, it kind of has those hallmarks of something that was AI generated. So I think a really good example of this, we were reviewing for part of our pre-review program a series of blog posts, and one of those blog posts had to do with the Forex market. And I think if you're familiar with how the Forex market works, so if it's off-exchange retail foreign currency, you have your Forex dealer, and you know a client places a trade with the Forex dealer, and the Forex dealer is on the other side of that trade. Well, this blog post that they had submitted to us had this really weird discussion in there about how Forex worked, and it kind of made it seem like the Forex dealer was like going out into the interbank market, and you know it was like matching the client with somebody in the interbank market, and that client was on the other side of the trade, and it just didn't really make sense, and it didn't really encapsulate how Forex really works in the real world. And I think what had happened was, like I said, since this kind of had the hallmarks of something that was generated by, like, a ChatGPT, is it was one of those kind of classic cases of what they call AI hallucination. And I think we're all kind of familiar with the term. I think a lot of us have heard the term hallucination before when it comes to AI. But for those who aren't familiar, you know, we're used to a computer being like a database, that if I ask the computer what's the capital of France, that somewhere in a database it says France over here, Paris over here, and it'll pull that information out for me. But when we're using an LLM, something like a ChatGPT or a Claude or Grok, you know, whatever it is that you're using, it doesn't act necessarily like a database. It's more like a series of associations. So, you know, somewhere in that LLM, there's that association between France and Paris and the concept of capital. And it sort of, you know, has those concepts in there and associates them. But an LLM, like a ChatGPT, is more similar to a person in the sense that it's not necessarily, you know, it doesn't have somewhere encoded in there that this is the precise answer. It just thinks it knows the answer, and it spits out whatever the closest association is. So unlike a person, though, so a person can tell you that, you know, I'm not necessarily confident in what this answer is, but an LLM is just going to very, very confidently tell you a wrong answer. And I think that's what happened in this piece that had to do with the Forex market. It was very confidently talking about something that wasn't necessarily true. So all of that being said, I think the important takeaway here is, you know, ChatGPT, Claude, whatever, they're very, very powerful tools. But if you're using them to generate your promotion material for you, it's incumbent on you to read through that promotion material to make sure it makes sense. And the thing is that you have very, very sort of precise esoteric knowledge about the futures market. You know a lot about futures. You know a lot about Forex. You know a lot about crypto. And a lot of the information that you have isn't necessarily readily available online where these things are being trained. So when it comes to these topics that are very esoteric and very not widely known, I think you tend to get larger amounts of hallucinations. And obviously these things are getting better all the time. But for the time being, just, you know, be on the lookout. If you are using these things to generate your promotion material, make sure you read through it, because at the end of the day, you know, this is your promo once you give it to a client. The other thing is, you know, ChatGPT doesn't necessarily know your specific requirements. So ChatGPT doesn't know that if you talk about the potential for profit, you have to talk about the risk of loss. You know, it doesn't know that, you know, if you have hypothetical performance, that there's a big long disclaimer that has to go in your promotion material. You know, it doesn't know that if you have, you know, 3 months of actual performance, that you can't put hypothetical performance in your promotion material. So because of that, it's incumbent on you to supervise anything that these systems are making to make sure that what's coming out of them is accurate. So does anybody have any questions on that real fast? So again, we're not necessarily telling you that you can't use ChatGPT or any of these systems to generate your promotion material, but at the end of the day, you know, be aware that it is your promotion material that's being used. So the other issue when it comes to promotion material has to do with claims about the use of AI. So we are beginning to see more and more claims where firms are saying that, you know, we're using powerful AI to drive our system in some way, shape, or form. So NFA does not necessarily have a precise definition of this is what artificial intelligence is. So, you know, for example, the European Union now has an actual definition of this is what AI is, and it's very broad and includes a lot of things. NFA doesn't have a definition. So because there is no precise definition, and because it's such a general term that can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people, there's a few kind of things to think about if you're making claims about artificial intelligence. And the number one biggest thing is that if you're making a claim about AI, if you're saying that you're using AI, if you say that you're using machine learning, to make sure that you're actually doing that. So that if you make a claim about, you know, using, you know, advanced generative AI to run our trading program, you know, if NFA comes out to your firm, you should be able to show us exactly how it is that you're doing that, so that you are actually doing the thing that you're saying that you're doing. The other thing, and this is more of just a best practice, which is, you know, if you're saying that you're using AI, it sort of would be a best practice in your promotion material to say how it is that you're actually using the AI. Because remember, you know, 229, NFA's compliance rule 229B2 says that if you omit information that makes it misleading, that could violate NFA's compliance rules. So I think the easiest way to avoid that is if you're making a claim about AI, to say specifically this is what we're doing, because I think one person's AI is another person's algorithmic trading strategy. And as long as you're clear as to what it is that you're doing, then I think there's less chance that you could have issues with potentially misleading a client. Does anybody have any questions about that? We have a question over here.
There's one up there.
Oh, okay.
No? Perfect. Hi, Maxine Klein, UBS. I had a question about the last piece. Would you feel like in the future maybe promotional material should have like a limitation section about AI and mention the risk of hallucinations? Because in my head I'm trying to piece away a sophisticated client who probably knows how AI generally works, but also, like you said, the intent to mislead or unintentional misleading. How would you square that circle right now?
So you're saying should there be a section in promotional material to talk about the risk of hallucination? You know, I think it depends on the material and what you're doing. You know, if it's something like you're using to drive a trading strategy. So, for example, if you're a commodity trading advisor or a commodity pool, and you're using AI to drive that system, I mean, I definitely think that that's a risk that needs to go in the disclosure document, because obviously there's a risk section in the disclosure document that, hey, here's the risks associated with the strategy that we have. But ultimately, I think it's very dependent upon the specific way you're using AI and what it is that you're saying about it. So I think of that question more in terms of a CTA. But there again, if you're an IB and you're using that to drive some sort of system for your client, I think that's certainly something you might want to disclose. And then over here.
Thanks. Hi. Beverly Duke, Corient IA. And my question is actually a little bit broader in that for firms that are using the we are not using AI policy, and not my first rodeo with that, how are you handling exams where perhaps you locate something and you say, this isn't human generated? You know, are you asking those kinds of questions? I know people are doing it. We're not stupid. It's more a matter of fact, how are we going to catch it? How are we going to stop it? Things of that nature. I've been on the regulatory side as well, so I know what it looks like when you're in a room with someone telling you they're not doing it and you know they're doing it. So I don't know if you've faced any of that. And then a sub-question, as far as promotional materials are concerned, and again, am I not close enough? Sorry. I have a really loud voice, so I don't want to kill everybody. The promotional materials, let's say we move into a, we're test driving AI, we're working with it, and I think there are sample groups within the firm itself that are doing that. We're not creating promotional material with those groups, but what if they are? And how are we going to catch that and say, hey, we've given you guys this opportunity to use AI. How can we be sure you're telling us that you're using AI properly or this, that, and the other thing? I don't know if you're facing any of that in the exams yet.
So I'll take the first part of it about the exams. So with firms that are saying they're not using AI, and then we come out there and we see it. So once again, AI isn't a forbidden item. If for some reason, let's say in their procedures or everywhere else, they're saying, you know, this firm doesn't use AI, then we might have an issue of you're not doing what your procedures are saying. If they're using AI for something, and I don't know, like Derek's question about, oh, they produced something. It was, to us, looked like AI, but they kept on saying they produced it. At that point, it becomes like he said, she said situation. We're not going to be like, oh, no, it's AI. But then we're still looking at all of the procedures or all of the documents from the standpoint of, is this reasonable to what the firm is doing? Is this reasonable to the regulations and rules? Is this misleading to the customer? So once again, AI isn't forbidden. I've had it where a firm said that they weren't using AI, but then it became one of those situations where they were also SEC registered and they weren't using AI on the future side. So then we had to have all the conversations again holistically for the firm versus any futures related items.
And I think, you know, somebody I think used the term regulatory amnesia, I think, which is to say that I think sometimes there's this belief that, well, this is a brand new technology, so maybe the old rules don't apply. But, I mean, it's pretty obvious. I mean, when it comes to 229, I mean, it says you can't say anything that's misleading. It says that if you talk about, you know, potential for profit, you have to talk about risk of loss. So it doesn't matter necessarily, you know, if you're using ChatGPT to produce that promotion material for you. I mean, at the end of the day, promo is promo. Somebody, there has to be a human in the loop. Somebody has to sign off on that. You know, a supervisory position has to review that material before it hits a client. So at the end of the day, I think it doesn't necessarily change a lot, but it does kind of raise some additional, you know, things that you're going to have to be aware of if you begin to use it.
Okay. Oh, I think we have a question over here. Hi. So, does it make a difference if you're using any form of AI for research versus using it to generate a trading signal, like in your claim?
So does it make a difference if you're using AI for research versus trading signals?
Yeah. So for example, you're downloading all this data from, let's take the example of futures, right? Like you're downloading all this data from the USDA about, you know, sugar and all these crops, and it's all in text format. You're using some sort of natural language processing to extract numbers from it, but it's not actually, you're not actually using any kind of machine learning model to make the trade decision of whether you're going to buy or sell. You're just using it to extract information. Does that constitute something that you have to put in your promotional as, yes, we are using AI, but even though you're not using it to make a decision?
No, I mean, so the question is, I mean, if you're using AI to sort of get information and sort of making trade decisions off of something that the AI has analyzed for you, that's not necessarily something that you need to put in your promotion material. I mean, if you're describing how your strategy works and, you know, it's a complete description of the strategy, then, you know, maybe you'd want to throw it in there. But, I mean, if you're just generally speaking talking about your firm, or if you're a commodity pool and you have a website that talks about your firm, I mean, it's not something that you have to say that we're using AI in our, you know, process of analyzing data. Because, I mean, people have used technology to analyze data for years and years and years, and it's not necessarily something that... you know, again, I don't think that using AI or a newer version of, you know, data analysis from AI necessarily changes what, you know, people have been doing for years in terms of using technology to analyze data for them. Okay, anything else? Okay, so then moving along. To digital assets. Jim, do you want to talk to us about digital assets?
Yes, thanks, Derek. So to reintroduce myself, my name is Jim Hurahan. I'm a manager in the compliance department. I've been conducting exams of digital asset firms for 4 to 5 years. So I just wanted, before we go into the slides, just cover a little bit of what we've seen and how things are changing, because as we go through the slides, I think you'll see how this is, how our approach to exams has changed over time. So, you know, in the last 4 to 5 years, what we've seen in this space has evolved. It's changing. You know, what we were seeing 4 to 5 years ago tended to be more wallet heavy. We're seeing a much different approach on exams today. We're taking a little deeper dive from time to time on exams. I've done exams where we've taken a deep dive in looking into cybersecurity. We've looked at internal controls. We've looked at wallets and trading. It really depends on the firm and what the firm is doing and their operations, how we're going to approach this exam and what we're going to look at. So it's a little different than what we do on some other exams, but we're really trying to learn about this space, see what firms are doing, understand what they're doing, and then really bring that knowledge back and look at our testing, look at our rules, and see what we have to do from an internal perspective to really examine and understand this space. Before we get into what we're doing on exams, I do want to cover a couple compliance-related matters. On the next slide, just to briefly touch, NFA's Compliance Rule 251, this is our anti-fraud rule. When it comes to digital asset commodities, basically it says, as NFA members, you can't commit fraud. It's good not to do. But just I wanted to point out that it currently lists only Bitcoin and Ether as digital asset commodities, and this could change in the future. So I just wanted to touch on that briefly. Moving on to the next slide, I want to talk about NFA's Interpretive Notice 9073. This contains the disclosure requirements for FCMs, IBs, CPOs, and CTAs. So it addresses it from a digital asset perspective. You know, it contains the disclosures that you have to have in your promotion material and disclosure documents if you're trading digital assets. So on the FCM and IB side, just to cover those briefly, for firms with customers trading derivatives, the interpretive notice requires that you provide NFA's investor advisory and CFTC customer advisory, both of which can be found on NFA's website. So there are requirements that you have to provide certain material to certain customers engaging in certain activities on the FCM and IB side. Once again, on the FCM and IB side, for firms with customers trading spot, 9073 requires that you provide specific disclosure language that basically says what NFA's oversight limitations are. So that's briefly what's in there with regards to FCMs and IBs. I did want to touch base or cover also what's happening on the CPO and CTA side. because the disclosure requirements are a bit different there. There is a verbatim disclosure required that's required that needs to be prominently displayed for CPOs and CTAs with regards to their trading of digital asset activities. You have to include that word for word. There's no variation allowed in that. You just need to disclose that. The other part of the disclosure requirement is you have to specifically list out certain things based on your operations. So you can see up here is a list of some of the disclosures that might need to be made. You might need to, you know, what I've listed up here includes price volatility, cybersecurity, technology, and fees. You know, these are things based on your operations. If you're doing these, you may want to, you're required to disclose these. It's not prescriptive what you have to include. There may be other relevant areas based on your operations that the interpretive notice requires you disclose. But in general, the disclosures should be tailored to your specific operations. If you read 9073 and it's not clear to you what to do or how this fits in with your operations, we do have a promo team that's a good resource to use. You can, you know, contact them, send them your promotional material, and they'll walk you through what's required, what you should be putting in there. But 9073 tries to lay out what's required to be in promotional material and disclosure documents if you're engaging in the digital asset space.
When it comes to those disclosure documents, if I can just jump in here, you know, I think one of the main things, so I'm on the group that reviews the disclosure documents, and I think one of the main comments that we typically make is that we don't know what you're doing, which is very important for the disclosure document review to know exactly what it is that you're trading. And there's a big difference between trading, you know, spot Bitcoin, you know, actual Bitcoin with a wallet, and trading, you know, Bitcoin futures on an exchange somewhere. I mean, those are, in many ways, two completely different things. So, you know, when you're writing up that disclosure document, whether you're CTA, whether you're a CPO, make sure it's 100% clear exactly which one of those that you're doing. So if you're saying I'm trading Bitcoin, say I'm trading Bitcoin futures, or say I'm trading spot Bitcoin, because like Jim was saying, there's a lot more disclosures that have to go in that disclosure document if you're trading spot Bitcoin versus trading Bitcoin futures.
Yes, okay, thank you. Just so I know where we are in the presentation. Next, I want to talk a little bit about the member questionnaire. You're all familiar with the member questionnaire. We've recently made some updates to it, specifically with regards to digital assets. So the overall objective of these questions is to understand your operations, what you're doing in this space, you know, what you're trading, how you're trading them, and is it material to your operations. And we found what we've done is we made some updates to the member questionnaire because we really weren't getting the information that we wanted or thought we were getting good enough information. So we changed the member questionnaire to go into more detail so that we can try to get the information we need to allow us to understand what the firms are doing, you know, what they're trading, and how material it is to your operations so that we can better risk assess and understand what our firms are doing. And then, you know, through that, we can identify those firms that we want to go in and examine or not examine more accurately. So I did want to cover the member questionnaire in a little bit of detail because it is important that, you know, the more accurately you fill this out, it really helps us to understand what's going on in the industry. As I go through this, it's really going to focus on the CPO and CTA side since that's most of the firms that we look at. If you're with an FCM, an IB, or an FDM, you know, the changes are analogous to what's going on in the CPO and CTA side. So as we go on to the next slide, I wanted to just briefly touch on what we're, you know, at the firm level for CPOs. We made some changes there. One of the main things we did was split apart digital asset derivatives from spot digital assets, put them in their own sections, so you have to fill out separate sections related to spot and derivatives. For the derivatives portion, just note that it includes derivatives that are traded on a traditional exchange, such as CME, and derivatives that are traded on not what we would call non-traditional derivative products like perpetual futures that may be held in an account held at a foreign cryptocurrency exchange. So it's traditional and then the non-traditional products, what we're putting in the derivatives category. The questionnaire will ask you to separately indicate if any NFA-listed pools directly invest in the derivatives or if it was done indirectly through another fund. And if you do, you'll just have to list the pool specifically in the questionnaire. On the spot side, The spot portion will ask similar types of questions as the derivative section, but it then goes into a little more detail. We're going to be asking questions about other spot activities such as lending, borrowing, staking, or if there's anything out, you know, in the digital asset space, there's also things we're not aware of. So if there's anything you're doing at a firm level in spot, you know, we're going to ask you to tell us what that is and then just provide some additional information so we can understand what's going on. And if you're doing this, we're also going to want to know if this is being done in any pools. Continuing with the member questionnaire regarding CPO prop trading activity, if your firm has its own prop funds invested in spot, there's three basic data points we're going to ask about. Where are those assets held, what assets you're investing in, and the types of activity you're gauging in. That's kind of the theme throughout the questions that we're asking. The assets held, where are they held, what are they, and then the types of activities. That's it for prop trading. At the pool level in the questionnaire, it'll, again, be separated between derivatives and spot, but we'll also be asking you some questions about, once again, where the assets are held, the types of derivatives and spot assets held. But we're also, when it comes to at the pool level, we also want to know what percentage of the NAV is invested in derivatives and spot. And that's important to fill out accurately because that allows us to know, you know, we'll know not just what you're trading and where, but we want to know if it's material to your operations. You know, if you know, you have a large pool that's trading a very small amount in, you know, digital assets or digital asset derivatives, we want to know that because, you know, materiality is also an important component as we look at these, you know, try to scope and risk assess member firms. So I know I covered that. Oh, sorry, one more slide. Our last slide in the member questionnaire is with regard to CTAs. So CTAs, the questions are similar. It's split out between derivatives and spot. We're also going to ask you for the number of managed accounts. We're going to ask you for the AUM. But we'll also be asking you to identify the exchanges, custodians, and brokers used for trading your managed accounts and where those entities are located. So there's a little bit different information there, but it's all thematically the same. So I think that's all I wanted to cover with regard to the member questionnaire. But the whole idea there is just, you know, the more accurately and completely you fill out this these questions as we ask them, you know, we're trying to get really good information from the members to understand what you're doing in this space so that we risk assess and allocate our resources, you know, as best we can so that we're looking at the things we want to be looking at. We don't want to give you a call thinking, you know, digital assets are material to what you're doing and we just had the wrong picture. So just cover that in some detail. Take the time to fill it out and give us the best information you can.
Move on. Let's just see. Does anybody have any questions about the member questionnaire?
Anybody? No. So now I just wanted to cover cybersecurity in the digital asset space. That's, you know, it's often a pretty big deal. It's something we can spend a lot of time looking at on exams. You know, digital assets bring with them some unique risk in this area and often heightened risk. Because, you know, firms tend to be very tech-heavy, and, you know, it's just inherently riskier in this space. So when you think about cybersecurity, you have a written information system security program, or ISSP, that should really be developed to, you know, reflect those risks. You know, we go into firms, if you're a tech-heavy firm, we'd expect to see an ISSP that reflects that heightened risk. But what should you be thinking about when you're thinking about cybersecurity? What are some of the things you should take into consideration or that we see as higher risks? One of the first things a robust ISSP should have is it should be tailored to your operations and address the key risks related to your digital asset activities. This might include specifically addressing things like, you know, there's the safety of private keys if you're trading directly on the blockchain, but also having different types of access controls in place. We'll go into it in more detail, but, you know, when it comes to access controls and, you know, securing funds, you know, one of the things we've seen recently on exams that firms have been moving towards is this concept of ring fencing, which is just a system of internal controls that isolates digital assets from other less secure areas of the firm. So, you know, the ring fencing concept is a combination of internal controls that includes whitelisting of addresses, two-factor authentication, authorized approval, and it's designed to create this ecosystem in which funds can be moved around, but they can't be moved outside of this ring-fenced ecosystem. So, you know, we're seeing how firms approach internal controls evolve in the digital asset space from a cybersecurity perspective. Another thing to consider is the cyber risk related to third parties that you're doing business with. You know, what due diligence are you conducting on the IT security practices of these third parties when you're engaging an administrator or, you know, looking at any other vendors? You know, do you understand their IT practices? How do you assess their IT security? You know, what processes do you have in place, and how do you document that review? And then finally, how do you, if you do have a risk assessment process you're using, how do you mitigate those risks that you've identified when it comes to third-party vendors? So more specifically, I talked a little bit about ring fencing, but more specifically, we've seen just specific internal controls in the cybersecurity space evolve. You know, lots of firms are using two-factor authentication. We're seeing more and different ways of implementing segregation of duties. And, you know, one of the most common things we see is just the whitelisting of addresses to create a secure ecosystem.
If you can pause just a second, I want to make sure I'm on the right slide here.
Nope.
Are we...
It's cybersecurity should be the slide.
Oh, we're still...
Yeah,
okay. Sorry.
Sorry,
I thought we moved on.
Sorry. Yeah, I just keep going. Once I turn it on. And lastly, you know, because it's cybersecurity, I just wanted to touch base on, if you're trading directly on the blockchain, you know, security of private keys is always a big issue. You know, how are you securing those issues? Who has access to the keys? I mean, you'd be surprised what we see when it comes to private keys for funds trading directly on the blockchain. We've seen firms that just write the key down on a piece of paper and put it in a safe and, you know, put it in the safes in the bedroom so it's all safe and secure in the closet. That may be just fine based on your scope of operations. You know, the keys are secure. But something to consider is just, you know, when it comes to private keys, just having a backup plan in place. If something were to happen to the keys, the private key, something were to happen to the safe, do you have another way of accessing that private key? And I say that because we have seen firms where, you know, if something happens to the private key, we've seen firms where they didn't have a backup plan in place. And, you know, if you can't, in this case, it was the keys were stored in a cold wallet. Something malfunctioned with the cold wallet. They could never retrieve the keys again. So you have to securely store the private keys, but you also have to have a backup plan in place so that if something happens, you have a way of, you know, generating those keys, but that backup plan needs to be secure itself. That issue's been around for a long time, and it'll continue to be, so I just wanted to cover it today. The last thing I just wanted to mention was, you know, from a cybersecurity perspective, this just happened recently, but it was the hack of Bybit. This was just a more complicated attack that involved hackers exploiting weaknesses in the transaction approval process, smart logic contract, and off-chain infrastructure. So I know that sounds complicated, but they were able to steal about $1.4 billion in a short period of time. So, you know, while it's a more complex attack, the concepts, obviously, of cybersecurity and thinking about controls and procedures and putting it all together in a solid program still needs to be done. And I'd also turn your attention to NFA Interpretive Notice 9070. That just is our interpretive notice that provides guidance to firms on the things that we're looking for in information security programs. So that's out there for your reference if you want to use it. So that kind of covers more of the compliance stuff. Now I'm going to move into talking about digital asset exams. We've been doing them for a while. I want to just cover, you know, what can you expect if you're scheduled for an exam? You know, what are the things you can expect us to ask about, and what are the things, documents we're going to ask you to produce? The first thing is just, you know, we're going to dig deep into some areas, so we tend to ask a lot of questions about certain things, and it varies from exam to exam. But there are ways you can help us get ahead of that. You know, there's information you can provide to kind of answer some of our questions, help us get started in understanding your operations, how you're trading and such. So the first thing that, one of the first things we'll want to do is, you know, if you can provide, we're going to want to do walkthroughs of certain activities. Generally, we want to do a walkthrough of the control and ownership of wallets. If you're self-custodying wallets, we're going to want to understand how you secure the private keys, but then we're going to want to understand how you access the wallet. You know, we're going to want to perform a walkthrough of that process, how you store the key, how you access the wallet, how you transact in it, what controls do you have in place to securely transact on the blockchain. And if it's possible, we'll even ask you to go into the wallet, show us you have access to it. And we've even observed firms actually move funds around, but we do that on a limited basis based on, you know, what the firm's doing that day. We actually may even do a walkthrough of the trading process. This, in digital asset space, what firms are trading and how they're trading changes a lot. We see very different things at many different firms. So we often perform a walkthrough of the trading process. We're going to want to ask you to show us, you know, how you access the blockchain, how you communicate with counterparties, you know, show us all of the wallets that are hit in the transaction. You know, we want to just understand, you know, some of these transactions, they can be very different based on the token or investment. So we often want to dig deep into some certain transactions that you engage in. And we may do internal control testing based, you know, depending on the firm's operations. So all these, if we do walkthroughs, really what all that's leading up to is we're doing is to our financial statement testing. We do that on every exam. We all know we send confirmations to confirm assets. But another important part and something we've been taking a deeper look at lately from a financial reporting perspective is really digging into more of the transactional data. The reason we're doing this is because in the digital asset space, you know, it's new. You know, what firms are doing, how, from a financial reporting perspective, how that information is being accumulated and reported, it's new. The products are new, so the processes are new. And, you know, if you look at the more traditional space, you know, involving more, you know, your more traditional banks and brokers, that's been around for a long time. That's much more established. And the reason we're taking a deeper, more granular look at these transactions from a financial reporting perspective is because we're finding things we might not see in more mature spaces. So as an example of something we might see, because we're taking a little different and deeper look at some of the financial reporting, is, you know, we have actually seen firms. We came across a firm where the firm was realizing gains and losses on the transfer of a token from one pool wallet to another. So they were just moving money around, but because of the way they were interacting with the admin, this transfer of pool from one pool wallet to another, the firm was actually realizing gains and losses based on the transfer. You know, that could potentially lead to, you know, misreporting your profit and loss, and potentially to artificially inflating profits. So that's kind of a simple example of that. We saw another firm where the firm was not accounting for unrealized gains and losses on open positions. What they were doing in this instance was the pool was creating option spreads to trade with a counterparty using smart contracts. So they're doing something which is a little more technical and complicated. But they were only accounting for the margin used on the trade. But then they were realizing the gains and losses once the trade had been completed. So they created their own option contract, spread contract on a smart contract. But while the trade was open, they weren't marking the spread, weren't marking to market the spread positions at all. So, you know, from a more granular perspective, we're seeing these things where, you know, when it comes to how you get the data and how the data is interpreted. And, you know, these kind of feed into the last point I wanted to make right now is what we're seeing in this space is, you know, firms tend to be very tech heavy. They understand cryptocurrencies and digital assets, and they're very focused on that. And then they hire an admin to come in, and, you know, the admin's going to handle financial reporting, bookkeeping, all that record stuff. But, you know, the admins are new to this space too. So you really need to, as a firm, pay attention to what the admin's doing, how they're, you know, how have they set up APIs? Are the APIs set up properly? What data are they getting? And is that data correct, and are they reporting that data to you correctly? You know, we're seeing a lot of firms that just kind of have created a firewall where that's the admin, we handle this side. It's your firm, they're your books and records, you're responsible for them. Know what's going on, know how the financial reporting is being done, and that it's being done accurately. I was just going to briefly turn it over to Derek, who is going to cover the next topic.
So first off, though, I just want to see, do we have any questions about digital asset exams? Something over here.
Good morning. I hear that you're talking a little bit more about compliance, but what are you doing as far as auditing and holding the FCM a little bit more accountable on how are they categorizing and using these wallets and breaking them down for accounting purposes? Are you getting involved in the actual auditing and the path of the wallets and the digital collection inside of the FCMs and the CPOs?
So your question is, are we looking at the FCMs and how they're holding the assets?
Or the pools. You're asking us to disclose all the information, the wallets, the categories of how we maintain the wallets inside the wallets of individual clients. So in a nutshell, yes. So this is going to be your template for us to evaluate and for us to follow the rules in which we're going with the digital side and the wallets and the securitization inside of the client's records in the wallets.
Mm-hmm. So a couple thoughts on that. What we do on exams is we look at the flow of funds and we try to understand, you know, where are the funds, where they're going, and who's holding them. And we do it from, if we're auditing a CPO, we do it from the CPO's perspective. But we will look at where the funds go, how they're held, how they're secured, and we will look at what other entities are doing to secure those funds and how those funds are held. It's different on every exam than the level of detail that we'll go into. You know, we can't necessarily, if I'm auditing a CPO, I won't necessarily start auditing the other entity, but we will look at their, depending on what we see, we will, and I've done it where we've, you know, been had concerns about the way assets are being held at other entities so that we can get comfortable with what they're doing. You know, just because, you know, it's similar to anything. You know, they're your funds. You need to know that they're secure. So we will look at their processes, what they're doing to how they're holding funds and how they're moving funds and are they being kept in the name of the pool and what security do they have in place. So we will look at that.
Okay, so in a follow-up question, on the FCM side of the bench, should we look more towards the CFTC as far as how we're building our books and records and our correlation for our audits? Should that where we should be? And then you're following the CFTC?
I mean,
I'm just trying to get a clear understanding of auditing and staying, not just auditing, but also reporting. Because when we report, and say, for example, I have an FCM that's going to be organizing their own digital coin and so forth and so forth. We are following rules and we are creating banking rules that follow that audit path and audit reports. Should we kind of mirror that type of philosophy as we going forward?
So I think that's a great question to have offside. So once this panel's over and we're going to have a little bit of time, that's a great time to discuss one-on-one. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take that first.
All right.
Did you just want to take that next bullet?
Yeah, just, and this is kind of as I mentioned earlier about the promotion material disclosure documents. I mean, really the most important thing is, are you actually doing what you say you're doing? And like I mentioned previously, you know, for a CTA or a CPO, obviously, it's very important that you're clear, you know, if you're saying I'm trading Bitcoin, that you say I'm trading Bitcoin futures or I'm trading spot Bitcoin. And then obviously there's an examination of your firm that we go out there and that we see that's actually what you're doing. And obviously, too, there's some additional disclosures, you know, a lot of additional disclosures under 9073 if you are doing spot Bitcoin. That's going to need to go into your promotion material. So, for example, especially if you're, you know, basically any member firm and you are talking about spot cryptocurrency, there's a specific disclaimer that has to go on that promotion material. And that specific disclaimer, you know, you may run into some issues if it's on, for example, Twitter, where you don't have a ton of space to actually, you know, write out information out of there. So you may have to find a way of embedding that in there somewhere, maybe, you know, with a picture file. I know some firms do it that way. So, all right. Thanks, Jim.
So on this slide, I just really briefly want to touch on one last point, which is due diligence on customers and counterparties. Obviously, you have to do due diligence on when you're onboarding clients, but we also like to see and understand, you know, what due diligence you're doing in terms of setting up relationships with counterparties. You know, this ties into NFA's Bylaw 1101, which is our Know Your Customer rule. You also need to understand and consider the products being traded and if there's any potential issues or limitation on who can trade those products. So we've seen on exams that we've had some issues with regard to clients being and pools being ECPs. You just need to understand if they're an ECP, is it potentially a swap, you know, as you get into the more exotic products in this space. That's the last thing I wanted to touch on there. So now we're continuing with digital assets. As I said, we're going to be asking for a lot of documentation. Some of the things you can provide us that will help us on exams, I've talked a little bit about documentation and flowcharts a little bit, but if you have whatever process documentation and flowcharts you have, if you can provide those to us up front, you know, having that information, you know, is going to help us understand better what you're doing, and then we can just kind of, that'll help us better risk assess and scope your firm. So any information in terms of process flows, flowcharts, you know, how you transact, who you transact with, that's very helpful to us. We will look at that as part of our planning and scoping process. One of the things that when it comes to digital assets that's a big help to us when you do a lot of transactions directly on the blockchain is if we can just get a complete listing of wallets, just all the lists of the wallets you're using as a firm, as the pool level. And the more you can provide us, the more detail, having that complete list of, you know, if there are customer wallets, if there are counterparty wallets, the more we can get and the more complete that list is and the more information we can get up front, it helps us a lot on the exam, especially when it comes to just understanding the scope of what you're doing on the blockchain, because we will look at that, but the more information you give us, the better decisions we can make about where we want to go. I've just noticed on exams that saves a lot of time. And then the last thing we recommend that firms have to really kind of get us started on exams, if you're doing a lot of transacting on the in wallet activity, we strongly recommend having a mapping of your wallets, the mapping going from the wallet to the general ledger to the financial statements. You know, as I talked about earlier, they're your financial statements. We found that having a mapping of this type available, and we will use it to help us understand what's going on, but it really helps the firm. The firms that have this have a more detailed understanding of the flow of transactions is and how that flows up into the financial statements. And if that sounds like something that's difficult to get, most admins have something like that readily available. And then lastly, just wanted to cover some of the common issues and things we've been seeing on exams. One of the things we see is a lot of, you know, as I've said, firms are tech heavy. They're often not they haven't been in this space too long, so we do see some more compliance-related issues. I just wanted to cover those in a little bit of detail. Some of the common things we see are with regards to late trainings, whether that be ethics or cybersecurity. A common thing, you know, if you're relying on the admin, is not all admins put the fund level information on the account statement and don't have the oath or affirmation. That's very common to see. Not completing the annual self-exam questionnaire, which is actually a good tool for new firms to use to make sure you're doing all those, you know, you're touching on all those data points. The self-exam questionnaire will kind of it's designed to keep you on track from a compliance perspective. Insufficient written procedures, third-party procedures we usually find firms don't have those. And then if you say you're going to review something, you should have documentation that you reviewed it. There's also, I believe, with regards to disclosures, we've touched on it. It's very common to see, you know, inadequate disclosures. And then we have seen things along the lines of misleading promotional material. The two most common things that we've seen with digital asset firms is, things evolve in this space quickly. So, you know, we've seen, you know, you set up a website, and then what you're doing changes rather quickly. You start trading. If you're specific as to what you're doing on the website, your promotional material or your disclosure document, you need to keep that updated based on what you're doing, because sometimes with these firms, what they're doing changes a lot. The products traded, where you're trading them. So you need to keep those updated. And then we do, you know, some people are big believers in this space. They want other people to believe in it, so we do often see statements of opinion in promotional material, and those need to be clearly identified. I know it's listed first, but the last thing I wanted to touch on is one of the things we come across rather commonly is the commingling of assets. You know, CFTC Regulation 420 prohibits the commingling of assets. And really just what we're seeing is, you know, this becomes a common theme when you're trying to transact on a foreign exchange that doesn't allow U.S. entities to trade on. Well, how do you do that? We run into, you know, firms have set up different ways of doing that, and a common problem tends to be keeping the accounts in the name of the pool. You know, pools need to be held in an account in the name of – pool assets need to be held in an account in the name of the pool. The most common way this occurs is there's a third party in the middle between you and the exchange. The funds go from the pool to the third party, broker, custodian. They're in the name of the pool. But then when they go to the exchange, we've seen examples where the accounts at the exchange where the trading is done are not in the name of the pool. So that's a violation of 420, and they're often commingled with other assets, generally from the broker or custodian, as they're trading in one account. So that's something we see commonly on exams, is, you know, commingling a violation of 420. That's all I had for today. I hope that gives you some ideas to what some insight into what type of information we're looking at on exams, what we're finding, how we're testing. And thank you.
Okay, before we move on, does anybody have any last questions for Jim? All right, up next is promotion material trends. We don't have a ton of time here, so we're going to get through this kind of quick so that we still have some time, too, at the end for any last questions that anybody has. So there's been a lot of recent things that we've been seeing in promotion material, and we kind of try to keep an eye on, you know, where things are moving, what people are starting to do. And some of these are recent trends that we're seeing more and more of, and some of them are trends that have existed for a long time that we still see coming up time and time again. So the very first thing I want to talk about is mixed product offerings under different regulatory regimes. So a lot of times we will see typically larger firms, you know, FCMs, FDMs, that are already, they're also registered on the SEC side. And they'll have large sort of consolidated websites where they'll talk about a lot of different product types that they're offering. So maybe they're talking about securities on one page, they're talking about futures on another, they're talking about cryptocurrency, they're talking about Forex. One of the things to kind of be aware of if you do have a website like that or any sort of promotion material like that is obviously there's a big difference between the regulatory regime for securities as there is for futures or the more or less lack of regulatory regime for cryptocurrency. So if you are talking about things like investor protections, you want to make 100% sure that you are kind of separating out those sections, separating out those discussions, so that you're not giving people the impression that some investor protections are there that aren't really there. So for example, you know, if you have a website that offers, where you're talking about offering futures and you're talking about offering securities and you're talking about offering crypto, you don't necessarily want to have a disclaimer on the bottom of every single page that talks about SIPC protection. Because if you have a page devoted to futures, that's not necessarily applicable to that page. So you want to make sure that those discussions on those pages are clear, you know, when you're talking about those investor protections, that you're talking about the ones that are relevant to the particular product that you're offering. So the other thing that comes into play is the use of affiliates and third parties to offer other other product types. So again, so sometimes we'll see, you know, mixed websites where you have, you know, an ABC LLC that offers security and then an ABC Futures LLC that offers futures. So if you're designing promotion material that's sort of combining the offerings of different firms, you want to make 100% sure that you're clear as to who's offering what on that website. So if you're talking about futures, you want to make sure that that's being discussed, you know, that it's clear that it's ABC Futures LLC that's offering the futures, not just ABC LLC that's offering the futures. And then where we really see, you know, where it really becomes necessary to kind of divide out those different discussions is when you're giving money to third parties. So a lot of times what we'll see in the cryptocurrency space is, you know, you'll have one of our NFA member FCMs, and they'll be offering their futures, or they have their platform where people can trade futures. But then they give clients the ability to trade cryptocurrency on their platform. But that currency, or that cryptocurrency that they're offering, or I'm sorry, or that cryptocurrency that you can trade on the platform isn't necessarily offered by the member. It's offered by a third party. So the client funds are held by, you know, some other firm, or the trades themselves are being brokered by another firm. So whenever you have a situation where, you know, you're the member and client funds are going somewhere else to trade, you want to be 100% clear in all your advertising about that relationship or any advertising about that cryptocurrency that, you know, this is some other firm that's actually the one who's going to be holding the trade. So don't say that, you know, it's ABC LLC that's, you know, going to be holding and brokering your funds. Say that, you know, this is offered by a different firm. So don't say that we offer cryptocurrency. You know, say that, you know, we offer a platform where you can trade cryptocurrency with some other firm. So, I mean, obviously this is kind of, you know, just in terms of protecting the investor, you want to make sure that they know who has their money at all times. But it's also obviously in your best interest, too. So, I mean, if you are, you know, handing a client's funds to, you know, the next FTX, okay, you don't want your customers, you know, you don't want that firm to go bankrupt and then your customers come to you and they say, hey, but the heck, you didn't tell me that my funds were with somebody else. You didn't tell me that my money was over here. What is going on, right? So that obviously not only protects the investor, but it also protects you if there is a situation where funds are finding their way to a third party and something happens to that third party. The next thing I want to talk about is the use of finfluencers. And this is kind of just a nice, fun way of saying sort of social media influencers that are advertising or talking about futures. So what we're beginning to see is we'll have individuals that aren't registered in any way, and they are, you know, they'll have a YouTube channel where they talk about how to trade, or they talk about the different platforms that they like, or they'll have a Discord channel where they'll, you know, give trading insights and things like that. And there are times now where we're seeing where our members have relationships with these individuals. And those relationships are greater or lesser. Sometimes they're supervising them, sometimes they're not. You know, sometimes they're compensating them, sometimes they're not. The thing to be aware of, you know, this is sort of one of those, you know, looks like a duck, quacks like a duck kind of situations, where if it looks like somebody is acting as an introducing broker, or if it looks like somebody is acting as an AP, then maybe they should be registered as an AP, or maybe they should be registered as an introducing broker. So if you're going to be entering into a relationship with an individual, and that individual is introducing clients to you, you really want to ask yourself, okay, is this person acting as an IB? Because if they are acting as an IB, or if they are acting as an AP and they're not registered, then that opens you up. Because then, you know, obviously NFA's bylaw 1101 states that, you know, you can't do business with someone who should be registered but isn't registered. So always be aware with those relationships if you plan on entering them. You know, this is a kind of a developing area. This is a developing area. I know the CFTC is looking into some of these individuals. And then we're also all seeing sort of companies then, too, that will sort of write promotion material. And, you know, they'll have websites that'll say that, you know, this is why we think this is a good broker to use, or this is why we think this is a good CTA to use. And here again, I mean, it's you know, a company that is introducing clients to your firm, and you're compensating them, whether directly or indirectly. You really have to be aware of, you know, what regulatory requirements they may have if you're going to do business with them. So the next thing is, in many ways, sort of related. Oh, did you have something you wanted to talk about?
Short on time.
Oh, we are running really low on time. So we're going to kind of blast through these next one. Referral programs. This is something that kind of comes up time and time again. You know, firms want to compensate their clients for referring customers to them, and that's the exact same concern. You know, are you turning your clients into APs? And if you are turning your clients into APs, is there a regulatory requirement there? Then the last two are application of NFA requirements on microblogging sites. And I kind of covered this originally with that 9073 disclaimer, but this really applies more broadly when it comes to hypothetical performance, that if you can't necessarily – so microblogging sites don't necessarily give you a lot of wiggle room in terms of what you can talk about because there's so little space to talk. So in those circumstances, you kind of have to find a way of getting those disclaimers in there to meet those regulatory requirements. And I think one way a lot of our members do that is by embedding an image file with the required disclaimers. And then the final thing is claims regarding the interbank Forex market. And that really just has to do with, you know, this is something we see fairly frequently when it comes to Forex, which is firms talking about the size and the liquidity of the Forex market. And obviously, always remember that, you know, if you are offering retail Forex, the counterparty to every client's trade is that Forex dealer. They don't necessarily have access to that liquidity in the interbank market. So be very careful when you're talking about it, that you're not giving people the impression that, you know, they're availing themselves of the liquidity of the Forex, of the interbank market, or that they're in some way, you know, in that interbank market. So we have run out of time. Real fast, though, do we have any questions?
The three of us are available throughout the rest of this member workshop, so we'll be around if you want to stop and talk about anything.
All right, thank you, everybody.